Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for August 25th, 2015. I'm Annalisa VanHook, and today I'm talking with Todd Rosen and Bingbing Wang about how epigenetic changes in the placenta that are induced by glucocorticoids promote labor. Hormones control all stages of female reproduction, from ovulation to labor. The timing of the production of various hormones and their interplay control not only ovulation and implantation of the blastocyst into the uterus, but they also control the length of gestation and the timing of labor. Corticotropin-releasing hormone, CRH, is made by the placenta, and it increases steadily during pregnancy and it peaks at delivery. During pregnancy, high levels of progesterone prevent the placenta from releasing CRH. Later, glucocorticoids like cortisol that are made near the end of gestation stimulate the placenta to release CRH and trigger labor. Bingbing Wang, Todd Rosen, and their colleagues have found that glucocorticoids like cortisol induce epigenetic changes in placental cells that stimulate the production of CRH and labor. Wang and Rosen spoke to me from the Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Dr. Rosen and Dr. Wang.
Hi, Annalisa.
Hi, Annalisa.
Todd, can you give us a brief overview of the hormone cycles that maintain pregnancy and trigger labor at the appropriate time?
That's a really complicated story and one that hasn't been worked out fully yet. What we've been doing at our lab at Rutgers, Robert Wood Johnson, is trying to understand these mechanisms that ultimately lead to a woman's pregnancy being delivered. There seems to be a clock that starts ticking somewhere in the middle of pregnancy. And when that clock goes off, it triggers all the steps that lead to labor. The endocrinology and the hormone milieu of pregnancy is really complicated. You have the placenta and the fetus and the mom all producing hormones. But the hormones we think are probably the two most important when it comes to triggering labor are the progesterone produced by the placenta and the cortisol produced by the fetus. As the fetus gets bigger and bigger, it produces more and more cortisol, and we think that is actually the way the placenta realizes the baby's getting big, maybe too big for it to supply it with its needs, with its oxygenation and with nutritional needs. And the progesterone produced by the placenta is actually the pregnancy maintenance hormone that keeps things going. So there's sort of a balance, and these two hormones work antagonistically, and ultimately, when the baby gets too big and the cortisol levels get too high, the pregnancy is delivered.
You mentioned that hormones that are produced in the mother, in the fetus, and in the placenta all work together to control pregnancy and the timing of labor. What about CRH, corticotropin-releasing hormone? How does it play into this?
CRH is actually, its biology is best understood in its role in the maternal hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. CRH is made by the hypothalamus both in men and women in response to stress, and ultimately that leads to cortisol production under stressful conditions. In pregnancy, the human placenta also makes CRH, and it actually makes it in relatively massive quantities. If we try to check CRH levels in the blood of somebody who's not pregnant, somebody who maybe who's postmenopausal or a man or even a woman who's of reproductive age but not pregnant, we're not going to find any CRH in our blood, but we find it in relatively massive amounts during pregnancy. We think that actually it's the CRH that's produced by the placenta and not by the mother's brain. That's the important hormone that controls labor. What Roger Smith showed way back when in 1995 or 1996 is that CRH levels rise exponentially as pregnancy progresses. And he also showed that women with the highest levels of CRH early in pregnancy tended to deliver the earliest, and those women with the lowest levels early in pregnancy tended to deliver later. So putting all of that data together, he postulated that CRH is part of a placental clock that determines the length of pregnancy.
What drives CRH expression in the placenta?
So that's actually a really great question, because CRH in the placenta is regulated exactly backwards from the way that it's regulated in the brain. So, for example, when CRH is produced by the brain, it ultimately leads to cortisol production by the adrenal gland. And then that cortisol made by the adrenal gland feeds back to the brain, and there's a typical negative feedback loop. CRH is actually downregulated, and there's less produced. But in the placenta, when the placenta sees cortisol, the exact opposite happens. More CRH is made. So there's a positive feedback loop in the placenta, and that's very, very unusual in biologic systems. So if you think about it, the placenta starts to make CRH. That traverses the umbilical cord, reaches the fetus, which then makes more cortisol. The cortisol feeds back through the umbilical cord to the placenta, which makes more CRH. And you have this loop that causes this rise in CRH. And when you see this exponential rise in CRH as pregnancy progresses, this is part of the explanation of why that occurs.
Prior to this current paper, what was known about how cortisol stimulates the placenta to release CRH?
Back to 2011, we found that cortisol activates the non-canonic NF-kappa-B pathway. In the placenta, you know, glucocorticoids stimulate just glucocorticoid receptor signaling. Then this signaling further stimulates the expression of this non-canonic NF-kappa-B pathway, specifically the RLB and the P52. Then these heterodimers can move in the nucleus in the placenta cells and in turn activate the expression of CRH.
And how does your current study build on those findings?
So then in current study, we just found that the non-canonic NF-kappa-B pathway, just called the RLB and the P52 heterodimers, can stimulate the chromatin remodeling complex. This complex causes the acetylation of the H3K9, then just causes the expression of the CRH in the human placenta.
Cortisol is produced under conditions of stress, when the body is stressed. So can the rise in cortisol in the mother in response to stress trigger preterm labor by acting on the placenta?
So that's a complicated question, or there's a complicated answer to that. There are some studies that show that women living under stressful conditions or experiencing stress are more likely to deliver preterm. But for the most part, I think most studies don't demonstrate that relationship. Actually, the placenta and the pregnancy is pretty well protected against maternal stress. Maybe one of the major mechanisms by which that happens is there's an enzyme produced by the placenta named 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, and that oxidizes cortisol to cortisone. So basically, that protects the pregnancy from the effects of maternal stress. We actually think it's much more placental stress, which is part of the mechanisms which lead to the onset of labor. And so through our research and through the way we think about these things, we actually think that the placenta can actually learn during pregnancy. One of its main jobs is to supply adequate nutrition and oxygen to the fetus. As the fetus grows and its demands increase, and the fetus is actually growing exponentially in utero, as opposed to the placenta, which its growth really stops at 32 weeks, and it realizes at some point that it's not going to give the baby the nutrients and oxygen. In order for that baby to get what it needs, it actually has to be delivered. And that's the stress for the placenta. Since the placenta is beginning to recognize it can't do its job anymore, it initiates parturition so that the fetus can survive outside of the mother's uterus. So placental stress is actually, in our opinion at least, a much more important trigger that leads to labor and the end of pregnancy than maternal stress. Even in cases of preterm birth, we think this is a much more important mechanism.
Do you think that your current findings have any implications for preventing preterm labor in women who are at risk, or identifying women who are at risk of preterm labor?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the ultimate goal of our study. It's another complicated question because preterm labor isn't just one disease. It's an end common pathway with many entry points. So if women are hemorrhaging during their pregnancy due to a placental abruption, that's one pathway in. You know, women can develop infections and that can lead to early delivery from preterm labor. But the majority of preterm births are unexplained, and we think that dysregulation of the mechanisms that govern the length of pregnancy might be part of that. And by better understanding this process, we might be able to make a dent in the preterm birth rate in this country. Preterm birth is the leading cause of death and disability in newborns. So it's responsible for about a third of child deaths in the first year of life. And we are actually worse at treating it today than we were back in 1990, for example. It's our contention that until we understand the mechanisms which drive normal labor, we're not going to get very good at preventing it when it occurs too early. What Dr. Wang and I have done in our lab with, you know, with the rest of our staff is we've run a screening study of multiple drugs that can inhibit the pathways that we think are important in the mechanisms that govern the clock of pregnancy. And we're hoping to run animal studies where we can inhibit these pathways and see if we can affect the length of gestation. If we can do that, then that would set up studies to determine if these same agents would be effective in preventing some cases of preterm birth in humans.
Dr. Wong and Dr. Rosen, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Bingbing Wong and Todd Rosen discussing a paper published in the August 25th issue of Science Signaling by DiStefano and colleagues. You can read that article online at stke.sciencemag.org. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.